I'm Joy Manning, editor of Edible Philly. Welcome to Local Mouthful. We're here to talk shop with obsessive home cooks everywhere. Marisa had her babies and is on maternity leave, so today I'm with guest host Emily Teal. Emily is food and drink editor at the Statesman Journal and a freelance recipe developer in Oregon's beautiful Willamette Valley. Thanks for joining me, Emily. Did I say it right that time?
You did. Willamette Valley. Yeah, they have t-shirts that say, it's Willamette, damn it.
Yeah, a little bit different than it looks on the page, but why don't you tell us what we're going to talk about this week?
Yep, this week we're talking about Indianish, magic shell, and gardening. But first, let's compare notes on something we read this week.
This was a great article from Eater that you sent my way, The Internet's Secret Tropical Fruit Stand. Do you want to tell listeners about it?
Yeah, so I read this earlier this week. It's a story by Lillian Min, basically about finding specifically mangosteens in this case, but any sort of unusual or difficult to find tropical fruit and buying it on Etsy just from a vendor where you might otherwise buy, you know, maple syrup or honey, something like that, but actually using Etsy Marketplace to buy fresh fruit.
Yeah, I had no idea that you could buy any food on Etsy, let alone a fresh fruit like
it sounds kind of illicit, right?
Yeah, but I did actually go on Etsy's food and drink section to sort of poke around, and there's all kinds of crazy stuff there.
Did you? Were you able to buy anything?
No, but they have stuff like keto churros, gluten-free donuts, like a lot of baked goods and sauces. Anyway, it's definitely a rabbit hole you could fall down. Mangosteens, though, have you ever had them?
I had them. I actually, I think I had my first mangosteen in Philadelphia. I think I bought them at one of the Asian markets on Washington Ave, just like out of curiosity, frankly. Mm-hmm. And I remember eating it, and Lillian describes it in the article as sort of like, you know, hard purple exterior with these little almost garlic clove shaped lobes of white spongy fruit. And I remember eating it and thinking, you know, this is really unusual. This is not like anything I've ever had before. It's really soft. It's really floral. I think it's probably closest to like soursop or something like that, if mm-hmm. you've had that.
No.
But I was eating it and I was like, I know this is special, right? Like, I know that this is not something that people can get very often in the U.S. But also not having that same kind of emotional attachment that she sort of seemed to have to, you know, the fruit itself.
Yeah, I guess she had eaten them while traveling in Shanghai. And when she came back to the U.S. at that time, they were mm-hmm. still banned because I guess they had a risk of having Asian fruit flies on them or something.
Right.
So the article said they were banned through 2007. So she did have that sort of like travel memory associated with them, I guess. She must have really, really wanted them, though, because she paid a lot of money for them. That's what stuck out most to me in the article.
Any way you slice it, it's a pretty expensive fruit.
She paid somewhere between $24 and $32 per pound. She said that she got 11 mangosteens in her order. So that was like $4.36 per mangosteen.
And when you think about it, in the fruit itself, you're talking about like maybe a quarter cup of fruit, you know, a third of a cup of fruit per individual fruit, right? These aren't massive.
Yeah. I mean, I shouldn't judge. Like, I've definitely splurged on food many times in life. I'm not sure I would do it on something as risky as fresh fruit, which, you know, some of the fruit she got was not good.
Yeah.
Rotten. But it was definitely an interesting little world to peek down.
No, I loved reading about just the kind of, I loved how detailed she got in the, maybe it's because I'm just a voyeuristic individual, but like how specific she got about the results of this experiment. Basically, like, I've tried this for you, so we can all sort of share in this knowledge. I don't know that I would have gone out of my way to buy mangosteens, but like I've definitely had fruit in traveling, you know, like these wonderful papayas in Hawaii, like the kind of things that you just don't see in North America very often that I think like if I really wanted to treat myself, that sounds way more special than like, you know, a fancy truffle oil or something mm-hmm. like that, you know, like another kind of specialty ingredient. But like,
you were tempted.
Yeah, I mean, I think I would be tempted, you know, like I traveled to Hawaii for the first time earlier this year, and I had papaya there just in the like hotel breakfast buffet, that was the most sweet and floral and like wonderful. It almost tasted like honeysuckle. I mean, just the kind of papaya experience that I've never had ever right. previously in my life. I would love to have that experience again. And every time I've since tried papaya, it's not even like on the same scale, you know, like I would splurge.
I forget what podcast I was listening to, but whoever, they were talking about pineapples and they were saying how in America, most of us have never even tasted a ripe pineapple and that you really only get them ripe where they're grown. So I can only imagine what pineapples
It's like being colorblind with fruit. It's like, if you could try this thing, and, you know, say you're from another place, but living in North America, like, wouldn't you shell out some money every once in a while just to have that sensory experience, like just to have that, you know, real pleasurable, like moment with, she mentioned mangosteens, passion fruit, guava, you know, papaya probably falls into that same category, right? These tropical fruits or these really specific citrus, something that, you know, just to have that moment of sensory experience, I feel like that would be totally worth it.
And who knew that you could get it on Etsy? Well, now we know. So as always, we'll include a link to this article in the show notes for today's episode. So check it out and tell us if you have, if you make any splurges and investments in tropical fruit for yourself. So let's talk about what's for dinner this week. I'm going to tell you something that I have made. It's the spinach and feta cooked like sag paneer from Indianish.
Yes.
Which I understand you have made as well.
Yeah, I did. Do you want to describe the recipe a little bit?
Sure. So I had never made sag paneer of any kind, really. So everything in this recipe was a bit new to me. You start out with a kind of a lot of oil. You put a quarter cup of oil in your skillet and you, as many Indian recipes call for, you toast some coriander seeds, actually kind of a lot of them, with some onion, ginger, and garlic. And then you add tons of greens. The recipe called for 10 cups or 1 pound of baby spinach, which I didn't have that on hand, but I did have half of a bag of frozen spinach and a bunch of baby kale. So I just approximated the right quantity there. And then you stew that, you cook that down till it wilts, and then you throw it in the blender with a little water. And then you just add the cheese in at the end just to warm it up. You don't want it to like dissolve. And then as many of this book's recipes have you do, you sizzle another 2 tablespoons of ghee or oil with cumin. Here's another word I'm going to pronounce wrong. Asafoetida?
Yeah, asafoetida.
And red chili powder. And then you sort of infuse that, the dish with that by pouring it over the top.
Dressing it.
Yes. What I thought was, you know, I cooked this dinner for my husband and Jill, my sister, and it was the kind of thing, usually they like will mull something over when they're tasting it, when it's a recipe that's somebody else's recipe. But before even the fork went back down to the dish after the first bite, they were both like, this is amazing. I like this better than regular sag paneer with the fat.
Yeah. So I think for me, this was a dish that's like, it sounds good on paper. Like I think a lot of people, you know, add the sag paneer or the mutter paneer to the, you know, the Indian restaurant order. Mm-hmm. But I think like, it doesn't feel on paper as it's written as a recipe, like a wild swap, you know, like it's a cheese, like it's pretty straightforward. But I think something about the textural difference and the added acidity of the feta really, it does so much. It's like a bigger lift in terms of flavor. It's a wonderful texture change to maybe the classic. I was surprised by how much I enjoyed it.
I did notice that, you know, Chandra Ram's Instant Pot book, what's it called? I think it might be called the Indian Instant Pot.
Every day. Oh no.
I'll put the link in the show notes. I'll look it up. But she also swaps feta for paneer. Uh-huh. So this must be something that people with Indian roots, but have been cooking here. This is probably not a new idea.
Harder to find. Yeah.
But it's a new idea to me. So you liked it too.
Yeah, I liked it as well. I remember, I think I've done it a couple of times now, honestly. It's one of those dishes that I think especially if you're using frozen spinach, which I also did entirely frozen spinach the first time I did it, just because I feel like paying for baby greens relative to the cost, you know, when you're just going to saute them down and puree them, it feels like a little bit of a splurge in a way that I'd rather splurge on like really nice feta, you know, mm-hmm. like I'd rather, like that's where I was going to spend my money. So I had this frozen spinach and I did it that way. I don't think the color was as vibrant as doing it with fresh, you know, it's a more muted green color, mm-hmm. but something about the way that the cheese really sort of yields into the sauce, I just really loved that. I think that, you know, that's something that's hard to deny, right?
Can I ask you a question about substituting the frozen spinach?
Yeah.
Now, I just sort of eyeballed it. I had like half a bag, but I, before we started recording, I looked it up a little bit, and the internet seems to think that one 10-ounce package of spinach is equal to 1 pound fresh spinach. So what did you use?
I don't remember what exactly we did. I think they were the little, they were the little boxes of mm-hmm. frozen spinach.
Those are 10 ounces usually.
Are they? Yeah. Mm-hmm. I think we had two of them in the freezer. And so I, just defrosted them and kind of wrung them out, you know, got it mm-hmm. to the same point that, of sauteing sort of in right. the original recipe.
That sounds right to me. I don't think that doesn't, like, the internet doesn't always tell the truth. And I don't think 1 pound spinach equals 1 10-ounce package. I think I would use two as well if I were going all.
I just feel like the way that spinach, especially baby spinach, I think because of the recipe, yeah, it wilts almost to nothingness. Mm-hmm. I felt like it was better to err on the side of, you know, more greens, and honestly, cramming more greens in, like, right. isn't that the point, right? Oh. Of weeknight dinner.
Did you use that as a fettita?
Yeah, I bought a jar. I really went on an Indian cookbook kick a couple of years ago, starting with Vibrant India, mm-hmm. the book Vibrant India, which is owned by was written by the owner of Brooklyn Deli, which does that amchar like pickle condiment. Mm-hmm. And her recipes are all focusing on Southern Indian food. And very traditionally, I think asafoetida would have been used in place of garlic or onion mm-hmm. to add that pungency to a lot of dishes. So I went ahead and bought a jar. It's actually a little plastic bottle of it. And I keep it inside a mason jar in my pantry. I think I've had it for more than a year at this point.
I went on an Indian shopping spree, but after the fact.
Yeah.
After I made this recipe, I thought it was good without it, but I liked it so much that I want to try it with. Do you happen to recall what kind of feta you used?
I think we bought the out here in Oregon, we have less specialty cheese options available mm-hmm. to us. I think I took the cheese counter for granted living in Philly, you know, at De Bruno Brothers, where you could get French feta, Bulgarian feta, or whatever. I think my go-to has become I think it's a Mount Vikos is the name of the brand. It's a Greek feta, and it's sold in a little, you know, 4 ounce brick. I think mm-hmm. that's the one that I used for it. You know, so you could get those nice sort of 1 centimeter cubes right. Without it all kind of crumbling into nothingness.
I availed myself of the cheese counter at Claudio's, and I tasted the French, Greek, and Bulgarian with this mm-hmm. recipe in mind. And I chose the French, and it was very good.
Wonderful.
But I'm sure it would be good with any of them.
Tasting sounds like how I want to spend my afternoon. But
well, I mean, because I really had a hard time wrapping my mind around feta and this recipe. I wanted to sort of like imagine what it would taste like before I went and I bought the feta. But it's good to know that there's some flexibility. You don't need a fancy cheese counter. So yeah, I thought this recipe was great. Dan and Jill loved it. You know, my tasting panel. So I'll definitely be making it again now that I have the asafoetida.
Yeah. Having done it now with both fresh greens and frozen, I think I'm likely to definitely make it again, but the use of frozen greens, rather, for me, that's the difference between like a project cooking and mm-hmm. like something I can have on the table in 20 minutes, you know?
Oh yeah.
Minutes.
It's like, a pretty easy recipe.
Yeah. Yeah.
So tell me what's going on in your kitchen workshop.
Oh man, I am. It's summer, obviously. It's July, and I am probably eating more ice cream than usual, which is saying something. And
Me
one
too.
of the things that we've been on a big kick of is making homemade Magic Shell. Do you remember
Now,
Magic Shell from
I
like
do, but in
the
the
90s?
it seems unthinkable to me, but in case someone doesn't know what Magic Shell is, can you describe it?
Absolutely. So I grew up with a Magic Shell in a plastic bottle that you'd buy from the grocery store. That was the brand name. And it's a basically chocolate syrup. And the magic part is that it hardens into a snappy, you know, domed texture over your scoop of ice cream. And then you kind of crack it with your spoon, just like you would a creme brulee top.
That's so interesting. I never had it at home. I always had it at Dairy Queen.
Oh,
where they
I did not grow up going to Dairy Queen. So
they dip your soft serve cone in the magic shell, but same wonderful result of that crackling, crunchy chocolate shell.
Yeah. And the way I remember it, you know, from childhood is that it's kind of a greasy, like it's sort of an ordinary chocolate flavor, but there's something about that snappy texture contrast, you know, the brittle chocolate with the smooth ice cream, like something about that was really addictive.
Delightful.
And, yeah, totally enjoyable. You know, if you had the option of Magic Shell, you said yes to that option. So I think a couple of years ago, I don't remember where I originally got inspired to make it, but learned that you can make it from literally two ingredients in your home kitchen, chocolate and coconut oil. The coconut oil being the thing that gives it that snappy, cold reactive texture, right? Because it hardens when it hits the, you know, it's liquid at room temperature or slightly warmed, and then it hardens as soon as it hits the cold ice cream. And so I think we started this by, you know, just like melting some chocolate chips and then adding coconut oil, stirring it together, put it over ice cream, you're good to go. And then it turned into like a bougie cooking project where we were using really high quality chocolate, you know, wonderful Askanuzi or dandelion chocolate with a little coconut oil. And then it becomes this absolutely indulgent, you know, addition to ice cream.
When you say a little coconut oil, I haven't made this myself, although I have always known that, or long known that it's possible. Is it like 75% chocolate, 25% coconut oil?
You know, I think the original recipe that got me started making it at home was closer to 50-50. But I think for me, that left, it was pretty greasy. You know, it kind of, after you'd swallowed it, it sort of coated your mouth. It was like kind of a little heavy. And now, to be honest, if I'm making it, I kind of eyeball it, you know, like I'll take a quantity of chocolate and then a few tablespoons, maybe a bar of chocolate and a few tablespoons of coconut oil, and then just kind of play with it. And sometimes it, you know, hardens to that super snappy texture. And sometimes it's softer, but it's still, you know, it's still enough of a texture contrast that it's enjoyable.
Still good.
Yeah, still totally good. And the thing that's really, you know, kicked off a renewed fascination with this is that I saw Erin McDowell, who's a cookbook author and food stylist, posted to her Instagram a recipe that she, I guess, had produced for purewow.com, which she called on her Instagram strawberry cold snap instead of magic shell. And I
That's
was like,
sexy.
What is that, first of all? But it's such a romantic name, isn't it? Like like the first chill of autumn, a cold snap. But it was pink, you know, so it looked like magic shell. It worked like magic shell, but it was bright pink instead. And I was like, what is that sorcery? So I went to Pure Wow, and this is a link that we have for you as well. And what she does is she uses white chocolate with the coconut oil in place of, you know, chocolate. And then she adds freeze-dried strawberries that she blitzes in a spice grinder or coffee grinder. And
that's what I would have guessed.
Oh my God.
I'm just giving myself a gold star because I was like, I bet fresh strawberries would be too wet. Anyway,
right,
continue.
Exactly. I think that the reason that the cold snap or magic shell works is that you've got this like fat concentration, and you couldn't add liquid to that without totally disrupting the emulsion, right? So So we had to try it, you know, we had to make the strawberry magic shell and that, or the strawberry cold snap. And now this is just like full on rabbit hole situation for us. Because like, I feel like, especially within the last couple of years, you're able to get your hands on many more freeze dried fruits, which would, you know, maybe previously have been sort of like an astronaut food thing, you know, like a very specialty grocery item. So now, and I haven't tried all of these yet, but like freeze-dried mango, peaches, like raspberries, like you could make magic shell with pretty much any fruit flavor you wanted, and then like a specialty sundae just with that.
And did you put the freeze-dried strawberries in the blender to get a very fine powder?
I just did the exactly what she said, spice grinder.
Okay. Yeah. Oh, spice grinder. Gotcha.
The one that we are most currently, Ben, my boyfriend, is currently obsessed with the idea of matcha magic shell.
Like, I love all matcha frozen desserts.
Can you imagine? White chocolate and matcha is already such a solid flavor pairing. And then
have you done it yet?
No, I think we're going to try it later tonight. Ran out of coconut oil. So we have to try it. That's the plan. The one that I'm really obsessed with is the idea of getting, I know that you can get freeze-dried sweet corn. I've occasionally seen it, like sweet corn kernels. So what if you did like a sweet corn magic shell over like blueberry pie ice cream, or like, you know,
that blackberry sounds so good.
Ribbon ice cream, right? Like something about that. I'm into it. Add some flaky salt. Done.
Yeah, I might have to do this. We're having, I think the temperature where you are in the Willamette Valley is cooler.
Yeah, generally cooler than Philly this time.
We're having a real hot heat snap right now. The opposite of the strawberry cold snap. It's the heat snap.
You deserve it.
So we're having friends over for dinner on Saturday, and I forbid Dan from doing any baked desserts because our air conditioner's not working that great. So he suggested ice cream. And if he is going to make ice cream this weekend, I obviously should try magic shell. That would be very impressive.
Joy, what if you made soft serve and then you did the dip?
That might be a little bit a step too far.
That could be like a dinner party freak out that you don't need to introduce to your life.
We're not having 12 people over for dinner. We're only having 2 people over. So like a vat of magic. You need a lot of depth to dip a cone into.
Not to be like a complete enabler here, but like it's literally, you can keep it at room temperature in your cabinet and just
pull
it
out. Oh, that's what you've been doing?
Yeah. I was putting it in the fridge for a while, and then I was microwaving it every time I wanted to use it. And then I remember that, well, maybe I'm misremembering, but I think when I was a kid, chocolate magic shell, you know, from the grocery store is just shelf stable.
Right.
And if you think about it, if it's the coconut oil is shelf stable and the chocolate is shelf stable, there's no reason that it shouldn't be fine, you know, to be in the cabinet. So we've been keeping it in the cabinet to zero ill effects.
Good point. Well, please do take pictures of your matcha experiment. Okay. I want to see that.
Yeah, we'll report back. I'll put it on Instagram for sure.
So I think one of the main things I wanted to talk to you about today while we have you as our guest host is your Oregon garden.
Oh my gosh. Yes. So I made a big change a little over a year ago, and I moved from Philadelphia to the Willamette Valley to Oregon. So we're about an hour south of Portland, and we found a rental property that's literally 2 acres and a house. And there's like the house came with chickens. Like there's 3 chickens that the neighbor, you know, that the neighbor has. And she's like, there's eggs, help yourselves, you know, just feed and water them every week, you know, make sure they're good. So we've like been plunged into this rural existence, which has been weird, but also is utterly charming. And there's like fruit trees on the property. We have no idea what varieties they are, and have just been doing our best to like learn about how you take care of fruit trees, because we want to be good stewards of these like beautiful plums and pears that are just like there, you know, growing in the yard, right? Like there they are. But this spring, we didn't do it last spring because it was like too much with moving drama. But this spring, we really, really like doubled down on the whole gardening thing. We built all these raised beds. First, it was going to be 4. And then And then once we started seeds, it was like, all right, well, four is not going to be enough. Like, we need to have six. And now,
can you list for me the vegetables you're growing?
You want the full list?
Is it too many?
It's not too many. It's not crazy. And there were certain things that we decided, like, look, we're just not going to be able to, like, we're not going to be able to do everything on the first go around. But let's see, how many beds do we actually have? I think we are at 8, and then Ben built a 9th one yesterday. So we're like still sneaking stuff out there periodically. But we are growing, the first things we planted were lettuces, like a lettuce, an heirloom lettuce mix, peas, two kinds of radishes, watermelon radishes and French breakfast radishes. We planted carrots, both multicolored and orange. We planted these beautiful red beets called Shiraz beets. Scallions, ton of different kind of tomatoes, all different kinds, basil, zucchini, patty pan squash, lots of different kinds of hot peppers, two kinds of winter squash. We have a spaghetti squash plant that's like put a squash the size of an egg at this point. It's just thrilling. We've got broccoli, cauliflower, kohlrabi, fennel, wow, Swiss chard, and kale. So and green beans, but the deer have been eating them like crazy.
What have you harvested and what has been a failure?
The first things that we planted, the lettuce and the radishes and everything, and the peas, those are basically totally harvested out. I think I'm going to pull out the last of the peas tomorrow because my boss at the paper, who she's also an avid gardener, she said when they stop blooming, they're done. Get them out of there. Which is funny to me because it's like squarely in the middle of July. And I feel like in Philly, it's like the peas, if they last until the beginning of June, right, before it gets too hot, it's like,
yeah, you know, I haven't seen peas in weeks.
Right. Right. Exactly. So, the biggest thrills have been the lettuces and the French breakfast radishes. In part, the French breakfast radishes, just because they're so, I don't even particularly like radishes, but it's so satisfying. Like you pull these beautiful greens and this like beautiful pink and like white, like perfect little vegetable just pops out of the ground. It's like absolutely
really thrilling. Featured prominently in your Instagram stories.
Oh my gosh. Yeah. And it's funny. Like I have been eating radishes in greater quantity than ever before because we're growing. I mean, that thing that they say about like getting kids gardening, like that has to work, right? Like
that applies to adults too.
It does. It does. I even think I made that sog paneer recipe using some of the radish greens once, you know, wow, like in with the spinach or in with whatever, just because it's like, I've grown this thing and it's this miracle to me. And like, I can't waste it.
Make me feel better though, by telling me something that didn't work this year.
Okay. So we like numerous,
just because I'm a very remedial gardener who can't grow anything. But
well, and we're really figuring this out as we go too, and trying to like maintain perspective on that. One of the things that was a fail, I hate to say it, was the watermelon radishes. They ended up getting the greens, like on one watermelon radish, right? Like was about the size of an egg, right? A baseball, something like that. But the greens were growing like half the bed, you know, like they were stretching out, like they were taking up way more real estate than we'd allotted to them. And I kept pulling them and testing them, and they were just like woody and like not very good. And I really had wanted to like have them to shave into salads, you know, to be those beautiful little two-tone radishes of dreams.
Right. But dang, Instagram,
those were a major fail. Yeah, they did not work. Eventually, I just gave up on them and I hauled them out. And I think that there's something that's sort of liberating about that in the experience of gardening. Like not everything is going to be a success. Some things are going to get eaten by deer, or, you know, you planted them too late, you screwed it up, and like you just start over, like clear out some space, you know.
We're definitely going to talk for something else. We're going to talk more about this if you are nice enough to co-host another episode with me. But for people that are interested in going in on a garden, were there any resources that you used that were really great as you ramped up, websites or books?
I had bought years ago, I think when I was still in Philly and my garden was limited to, you know, 5-gallon buckets on my concrete slab backyard, I had bought a book called You Grow Girl. And that's been a nice resource. And then a major resource for us has been our county extension office, you know, like that, that's been the most direct, like, mentorship that we've been able to get. Also, my boss, the avid gardener, who's been able to give me tips. I really feel like gardening is kind of like baking bread, you know, like you just learn by experience, and it really helps to have somebody who already knows what they're doing, you know, to be a mentor. But definitely the county extension has been able to say, like, no, you're doing it wrong.
Those are good tips. Well, before we wrap this episode up, I'm hoping that you'll share with us something that you are loving.
Yes, absolutely. I, right now, I mean, heart of July, it's not terribly hot here. And one of the things that is just going crazy at the farmers markets is berries. We are, in Marion County, and, the, namesake, that's the namesake place of the Marion berry, which is probably Oregon's biggest export, you know, in terms of, distinctive food. I think Eater did a map earlier this year of, like, you know, what's the most iconic food from every state for Oregon? It's Marion berry pie. So
I've what are they like? I've never had one.
Yeah, they look a little bit like a blackberry. And in fact, they are a cross of two different blackberry varieties, I learned recently. But they're longer, like the body of the fruit is longer. Mm-hmm. And they have a distinctively floral aroma. It's something else. You know, blackberries, I feel like growing up, they were sort of just generally sour, you know, like blackberries, like they have a perfume, but kind of like apricots, like more often than not, you're not getting, like, maybe you're not getting the full experience, you know? So yeah, they've got this wildly floral element to them. And so I've really been enjoying those, kind of how special and new they still feel. Have you been seeing some berries there in Philly?
Blueberries, you know, we're really deep in the blueberry. New Jersey, you know, is one of the big blueberry centers. So it's not as exotic as a Marion berry, but I've definitely been eating a lot of them. And I can berry vicariously through you on Instagram.
In fact, I brought some home to Philadelphia after a trip to Oregon before we'd actually moved here to Ben Wink at Three Springs Fruit Farm. Something I'd never seen before coming here was pink lemonade blueberries.
Oh, wow.
Have you seen them yet?
No.
They look just like a blueberry. You know, they've got the little star blossom end on them, but they are yellow/pink. They have like a Rainier cherry, you know, they have a yellow color with like a pink cheek on.
And you
them.
Think I should be able to see them here somewhere?
Well, if Ben Wank has gotten on it and actually planted them. Yeah, I think that, and I did a little research on them. It seems like they're a widely available plant that you can buy. Better Homes and Gardens has an article on planting them yourself. Like a wonderful kind of a tart, bright version of a blueberry that, you know, they don't taste like pink lemonade, right? But they taste like blueberry through a different lens, you know? It's just a wildly, wildly different experience. So
I'll have to keep my eyes peeled for that and see if I can get in on the exotic berry action.
No, somebody's got to have planted them, right? But yeah, I mean, here I haven't had this experience before. I feel like mostly berry season, it's at least on the East Coast, it's kind of like one berry at a time, right?
You get very much,
right? You get blueberries, you get blackberries, you get raspberries. Maybe there's some overlap in there, but mostly it's one at a time. And here, I can literally go to the farmer's market and buy a little, already packed up for me, cardboard box with six half pints in it. Marion berries, blackberries, raspberries, blueberries, tay berries, which we haven't talked about, which is a cross between a blackberry and a red raspberry. That's kind of like a dark red color. And to me, it has like a caramelized raspberry flavor. And then cherries, you know, all at once, like all happening, like the most glorious fruit salad possible for a pittance, right? Like here it is, soak it up.
Well, I hope listeners who live in the Oregon area are taking advantage of this berry buffet, where I will just look on jealously.
I feel like I'm not taking enough advantage of it. It's like fleeting, you know. No matter where you live, I feel like you could always eat more. You could always treat yourself to more berries in summer.
True. That's so true. Well, thank you so much for guest hosting with me today, Emily. It's been great to have you, and I hope you'll come back.
It's been a real pleasure. Thanks so much.
And that's it for this episode of Local Mouthful.
Our thanks go out to Dan Call for editing the show, to Saul Rosenbaum for designing our logo, and to Raina Rose for providing the music. And thank you for listening. If you like what you hear, make sure to subscribe via iTunes or your favorite podcasting app. Please follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at Local Mouthful. Sign up for our newsletter, catch up on past episodes, and check out our show notes at localmouthful.com. Until next time, happy eating.